This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After much discussion between CMS and the town of Matthews, the town deals a blow to the schools by urging the passage of a bill allowing the town to start their own charter school. One of Jerry Richardson's accusers comes forward with an open letter published in Sports Illustrated. City Council's discussion of affordable housing reveals some differences in philosophy and approach. CMPD repeats their request for raises, and the Atrium Health saga continues. Our roundtable of reporters has details on those and other stories this hour. Gwendolyn Glenn joins us from our WFAE newsroom. Good morning. Welcome. Good morning. Dion Roberts is here from the Charlotte Observer. Thanks for being here.
Hi.
This is your first time. We'll be gentle. Kirsten Garris returns from Spectrum News, where she's a government reporter. Hello there.
Good morning.
And Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of Q City Metro. He, too, is with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're all in our studio. We're all on the radio. But if that's not enough, you can watch us on Facebook Live this morning. Let's start with Jerry Richardson. Yesterday, Sports Illustrated ran an article featuring one of the people accusing Panthers owner Jerry Richardson of sexual and racial workplace misconduct. She came forward in a series of, well, I don't know that she came forward, but she, I guess, sent these letters to Sports Illustrated. They chose to publish them anonymously, in which she alleges verbal and physical sexual misconduct along with suggestive handwritten notes. What exactly is she alleging? Kirsten.
She's alleging a lot of things. Some of the notes talked about some of the allegations that were mentioned in the first Sports Illustrated article that was posted in December that was really explosive and kind of brought to light Jerry Richardson's activities, things like, you know, getting her nails done, talking about just touching inappropriately. And what was interesting to me is that she didn't just call out Jerry Richardson. She called out the NFL. She called out Ron Rivera and really said, hey, these are different things you all did that added to the problem. So I really think...
What was the problem with Ron? I didn't understand that.
Well, I thought it was interesting. I thought she had a good comparison between what happened with Gayle King and Nora O'Donnell when they found out their colleague at CBS, Charlie Rose, had been accused of these things. You know, she talked about how they said, you know, we're still trying to process this. We being Gayle and Nora were saying they're still trying to process this, but we know this is not the man that we know. Versus Ron was like, hey, you know, he didn't necessarily take a side with the women, and I think this accuser wanted him to take more of a stance.
She also called the NFL investigation, which is still underway, mm-hmm. a farce. Why?
Probably because we haven't heard much from it. We don't know.
It also wrapped up in the non-disclosure agreement that she signed, and they can't investigate that because if they do, they will break her non-disclosure agreement, and there are penalties for doing so. Is that correct?
I think so.
Well, according to Sports Illustrated, Jerry Richardson will not allow the women who signed the non-disclosure agreement to talk to the investigator. That is what Sports Illustrated said. So the implication was there that is what's holding up this investigation. They can't get any of these women to talk because they've taken money for silence.
So she talked, but she's talking anonymously. She identifies herself only as a female Panthers staffer who worked directly in football. That's a quote. Richardson didn't protest or even fight the earlier allegations. He just decided to sell the team. Why then won't she identify herself? Because she would then break her non-disclosure agreement? Is that why?
That might be the case. I can't answer that directly, but I know we haven't heard from Richardson on this, but we did hear from the Panthers, and they put out a statement on Twitter yesterday basically saying since the allegations started end of last year, they have been doing their best to kind of, you know, remedy these issues of workplace misconduct to make sure that, you know, these claims don't go. They're looking into them, obviously, with the investigation, but they are trying to make cultural changes. And now their new CFO, I think, is a woman. So, I mean, they are trying to take some steps.
So Sports Illustrated published these letters in which she says, and this is a quote, I was not allowed in the locker room, weight room, or team hallways. I was not allowed to eat in the football lunchroom, was not given a staff locker, was not allowed to fly on the team plane. I was not given team attire, was not allowed at practice, was not paid equally. Are we to assume that other women working for the Panthers are allowed in the locker room, the weight room, the airplane, et cetera?
I don't think so. The way I read it, and others may have read it differently, but the way I read it, she was implying that was true of other women as well. I don't know about pay and things like that, but the implication was certainly that women were not allowed in the weight room. They weren't allowed in the halls, in the players' cafeteria.
Would there be a reason for them to be in the weight room or the locker room, for crying out loud?
I don't know, but as she worded it in her open letter, there were male colleagues who have similar jobs, or at least that was certainly the implication, that male colleagues were allowed in these places.
Okay. The publication also printed photos of notes that she alleges Richardson wrote to her. One directs the woman to get a manicure, a pedicure, and facial, and instructs her to wear lip gloss before a game against New England. Quote, "If I could, I'd pamper you more, rub your feet, shave your legs, put lotion on your body, etc., end quote. And in that open letter, she says, quote, "I didn't know what to do when you summoned me to your personal office, instructed me to sit in the chair across from you, pulled my chair towards you so you could sandwich my legs, which you proceeded to rub between yours. I didn't know what to do when you called me to your stadium suite in the middle of the week so you could take off my shoes, place my legs in your lap, and rub their entire length from toes to crotch. I didn't know what to do when you put your hands in my mouth for me to kiss them. I didn't know what to do when you asked me uncomfortable, sexually charged questions." There's a lot in there.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I think what this did was really put a face on these allegations, even though the woman maintained her anonymity. And we knew in very broad strokes what some of the accusations were. Listening to one person talk about these allegations and how they made her feel, to me, was hugely powerful. The other thing that jumped out at me was how, and I think she has a point there, and Sports Illustrated raised this as well, how even in the era of this Me Too movement, this NFL thing, or at least this thing with the Panthers, it has remained largely quiet and undercover. It has not bubbled up like some of these other allegations.
Hmm. By the way, she signs all these letters, a Jerry Richardson victim still too afraid. Afraid of what? Her financial settlement or non-disclosure being fined because she reveals her non-disclosure agreement or because of other repercussions?
It's hard to say. Obviously, I can't speak for her, but I mean, we think about like what you just read was really, powerful for someone to come out and say these things. And it's tough when it sounds like she's working in a culture where women really couldn't stand up for themselves.
Well, let's flip the coin. I know this is not a popular thing to say during the Me Too movement, but these are serious allegations.
They are.
Creepy allegations, and they're made anonymously.
Because oftentimes women aren't heard. I think that's the thing. Oftentimes women's, their allegations, their concerns aren't always brought to the forefront. People don't believe them. There's a lot of victim shaming. So this is scary to say, okay, I'm going to put myself out here and say all these things that happened to me. I mean, I'm sure there are other women who felt the same way, but they were like, well, I can't say anything. Who's going to listen to me? And this woman said, hey, I'm going to share my story. And I think big kudos to Sports Illustrated for letting her voice just shine. And they didn't, they let her voice literally do all the talking.
And too, as you said, we don't know who she is. So it might be a thing. She might still be in the industry and afraid of backlash.
And maybe currently employed at the Panthers, right?
Or somewhere else. We don't know.
We don't know.
Yeah.
And to go to your point about these just being allegations, Sports Illustrated did not go into detail about how it vetted these allegations, but it did say that they did investigate these allegations. And I think the other thing that gives credence to these allegations are these handwritten notes, which Sports Illustrated took photos of.
Okay. Well, let's move on to something else that's been relatively rambunctious, and that is what's going on in Matthews versus the Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. State Legislator Bill Brawley introduced a bill, I think it was late last year, House Bill 514, that would allow officials in Matthews to create a charter school. It has not become law yet, and last week, I think, CMS met with the town board to encourage them to ask Brawley to withdraw the bill. Instead, the Matthews board endorsed the bill 4-3. Why, Gwen?
Well, first of all, they have had 16 meetings, they said, over the past year with Matthews officials regarding this. And Matthews officials are saying things like students can go closer to home if this bill passes, if they are able to create their own charter school. They're saying that it'll give students more choices, but CMS officials are saying that it will lead to increased segregation. Students will have fewer choices because they won't have a lot of the options that CMS offers, such as their magnet school program, such as the athletics. And so it's a big battle that's
brewing. But we're not talking about evicting Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools. We're just talking about opening a charter school. So does that CMS argument that will decrease choice really hold water, because you can still send your kid to the public schools?
Well, it's a thing of these students, it's only going to be able to build a school that will have about 500 to 700 students. So you'll still have some Matthew students who are going to be in CMS schools. And they're saying, too, that it may be an issue where taxes may have to go up in order for them to do this. So they're saying it's only going to be about 10% of the students who will benefit from this. Taxes might go up. So
they held 16 meetings over the course of the last, I don't know how many months, and CMS alleges that in those meetings they offered things to sweeten the pie, and Matthews offered nothing in return. So board chair Mary McCray and board member Ruby Jones say that these conversations were all one-sided.
To date, Matthews has offered not one thing in these compromise discussions. They simply have wanted all or nothing.
There has and never has been a willingness to compromise. They have been about ensuring that they remain separate.
And Jones went on to say that this would be unfortunate for Matthew's young people because they will go on to live in a diverse world. Some say race is definitely a factor here. Members of the board say it's about ensuring, the members of the Matthews town board say that this is about ensuring their children can go to a school close to home, as you said, Gwen. The school board's Erica Ellis Stewart had this to say.
This creates a slippery slope of further segregating our school system locally and potentially across the state.
So does the school board see this then as a race issue?
Well, one thing they said yesterday, they had a meeting, the CMS legislative breakfast that they have started to do on their own with legislators, and they had about 10 there, one Republican and the rest were Democrats. But one thing that they did say that they don't think, they're not accusing Matthews of having a racial intent when this bill came up. So they said they wanted to be clear about that, but they're saying the effect, if it does go into effect, will increase segregation.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that breakfast meeting that they had. Jeff Tart was there, State Senator Jeff Tart was there. Mary McCray has been critical of the town board and Matthews for holding
not holding public meetings
with residents before taking their vote. Jeff Tart is suggesting.
He's suggesting that when they were talking in a roundtable discussions, that maybe a referendum would be the way to go. So that way CMS doesn't make the decision. The General Assembly doesn't make the decision. Right now it's in the Senate has not voted on it. It's in the Education Committee, and it's not on the agenda right now for the last that I heard. So he is suggesting maybe since those public meetings and town hall meetings that CMS, by the way, will be holding town hall meetings next week on this, because they said they want to hear from residents. And they said because that didn't happen, maybe a referendum would be the way to go.
Would that referendum only be in Matthews, or would it be countywide? Very quickly.
Right now, they're just kind of thinking about it. So I think it would be just for Matthews.
We'll talk some more about this when we come back. It's the News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. This week on the FAQ City podcast, WFAE listener Barbara Randolph wants to know, what has been the result of the 287G program, and what will happen to its deportation policy after the May primary? Listen to this episode of the FAQ City podcast right now on iTunes, NPR One, and on WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Gwendolyn Glenn is here from WFAE News, along with Kirsten Garris, our government reporter from Spectrum News Charlotte, Dion Roberts, reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We'll get to you in a second. I've got some questions for you, Dion. And Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. We're talking at the moment about this school situation at CMS in Matthews. Matthews is 80% white, the town of Matthews is. So if this is truly not about race, if it is truly about wanting kids to go to schools that are close to home, was it at all addressed during the recent pupil reassignment plan? The fact that we could come to a school closer to you?
Well, one thing that was said that they gave that as a reason why this came up initially, that they feared that their students would be dispersed all over in terms of the student assignment plan. The fears that they had did not come to fruition. They got basically what they wanted in the student assignment plan, and the few changes that were made were changes that they asked for. So those fears that they talked about didn't happen with the new student assignment plan. And you had a lot who said, when they were talking in these 16 meetings with Matthews officials, said that they talked about control and wanting to maintain control of their where their students go. And Erica Ellis Stewart said that, you know, it was just about power. And they have said that, okay, if this does pass, we're not necessarily saying that we will put in an application for a charter school, but, you know, they looked at it as leverage that they can hold over CMS to keep their issues on the radar, which Rhonda Cheek really blasted them for at the school board meeting. She said that's no way to negotiate in good faith.
Well, some people on the school board, and they all chimed in on this, were pretty upset about this. And
they are
saying there will be ramifications, or there certainly could be ramifications. Last week, Mary McCray speculated that perhaps CMS might reassign hundreds of Providence High School students to Butler, which is in Matthews, I think. This week, school board member Rhonda Cheek also put it just as plainly.
When the back pocket threat of this little charter school bill is hanging right out there, I would ask my colleagues for us to reconsider any money that's being spent in the Matthews town limits from our previous bond to be put on hold, and for us to reconsider spending any money down there.
I know that sounds like she's upset, but doesn't that make sense? If they're going to do something that's going to hurt CMS, why should CMS spend any money in the interim?
She wasn't the only one who said that. You had other board members who said that. Well, if they say they are willing to pay for buildings, then why should we put our limited funds in Matthews? And they talked about maybe even reassessing money that's in the bond for those areas, past bonds rather, and maybe reassessing and taking a second look at and maybe pulling some of that funding back. Now, this bill, if it does pass, they would be allowed to use property taxes to fund, to build this charter school. So that's something new that's never been done before. And that's where you talk about, well, they might have to
raise taxes,
property taxes.
Because they'd still be paying for CMS out in Matthews, right?
Right. And CMS legislative liaison Charles Jeter said that on the extreme end, taxes could go up as much as 47% in order for them to be able to afford to build a charter school.
Sean Strain, who I think is a new member of CMS, does he not represent that area?
He does.
He didn't take a position either way on this. Why?
He didn't. He kind of stood on the fence on that, and he said that, but he defended kind of, he didn't take a position one way or the other, but he kind of defended what the position of the Mint Hill officials by saying that I have a faith that they will not go forward with this, you know, and they're saying, oh, if we do, we will get input as everybody's been asking us to do.
I think it should be pointed out that the mayor of Matthews, Paul Bailey, is a former school board member.
Exactly.
He left the school board to become the mayor, which I think allowed Sean Strain to take that seat. Which side is he on?
Well, he voted for it. So we know he supported the resolution from, I think, Monday night that the town board passed saying we do support HB 514. And I know Mayor McCrae also called him out, Paul Bailey, saying, hey, you were on this board with us for 4 years and this never came up. You didn't talk about this. And she says, you know, the talk about Matthews not being necessarily happy, those rumblings probably happened while you were on a school board and you didn't bring it to our attention. So she kind of called out Paul Bailey on the dais that night as well.
So even if House Bill 514 gets approval in the Senate and goes on to become law, and that would allow Matthews to build their own charter school, not necessarily, because they still have to go through the process of applying for a charter exactly. And then go through the state selection process. So even if the bill passes, how long could it take for them, if they are approved, for them to start?
I guess it could be years, because they also have to come up with the funding and how they're going to fund this. What type of school is it going to be? What grades will be in this school? So there are a lot of issues that they would have to decide.
I don't cover education, but do we know of the last example of a municipality in North Carolina doing this, opening up a charter school?
Well, to do it this way, this would be a first. And also the bill would allow, say, for instance, if they say, okay, we don't have enough money, it would allow them to bring in a for-profit partner. No one else in the state can do that, but the bill would allow them to bring in a for-profit. For-profits can only manage a charter at this point. They cannot create it
here when Erica Ellis Stewart talks about, I think it was her talking about the slippery slope, mm-hmm. isn't the fear here if this law passes and Matthews opens its own charter, it will be the beginning of the end of public schools, because every city or town of any size will probably want to do the same thing. And you just can't do that, can you? And still have healthy public schools, can you?
They said exactly that. And several board members expressed that fear that this would have a snowball effect that they even named. They said Cornelius will come to us, and they just started. And then statewide, it would have ramifications statewide.
And isn't that what, there's an organization called ALEC, which has had, and Arthur Griffin, who used to be the CMS school board chair, told me about this, and they have opinions about a lot of different things and policies about a lot of different things that are very, to the right, I guess it's the quickest and easiest way to say this, and one of their goals is ending public schools.
I'm not familiar with that issue.
All right. So let's talk about something else to deal with the schools, and that is this week the North Carolina Values Coalition urged parents around the state to keep their children home to protest what they call graphic, gender-bending, promiscuity-promoting sex education in public schools. Did parents follow that suggestion? Did people walk out or keep their children out of schools last Monday? Across the state?
Well, I know I can't speak for across the state. I asked for absentee numbers from this past Monday and the Monday before, and there were more absences this mm-hmm. past Monday, but CMS can't disclose why people were absent, so we don't know for sure.
And why this protest now? What provoked this suggestion that parents keep their kids out of school now?
It sounds like this was part of a national movement. It wasn't, you know, all 50 states, but there were cities in Texas, West Virginia, and Virginia, Indiana, who all had similar walkouts that day. And it was from a group of moms who kind of met online and said, hey, we're not happy with the educational materials being used for sex ed in schools, so they wanted to speak out. I know NC Values Coalition was joined by, she calls herself the mommy activist. She's a conservative blogger who joined them that day and talked about how she wasn't happy about it in her school. She started talking about it, so now she's kind of gone across the country to share her message.
So the NC Values Coalition says they have concerns about the Welcoming Schools program that CMS uses to help with acceptance of LGBTQ students. What exactly does that program consist of? What are they teaching in sex education classes here and elsewhere in the state that these folks find objectionable?
Well, the state is required to teach some form of sex education just because that is the standard, but they can kind of choose the materials. The Welcoming Schools program is not a required curriculum. It's more of a set of resources that is in conjunction with the HRC, which is the Human Rights Campaign. But it is a set of resources for teachers to use if they have students who want to talk about LGBT issues or are going through different LGBT-related concerns.
And the NC Values Coalition alleges that the Welcoming Schools program violates parental rights. Can parents opt out their children from this program? Do they have to participate in this? Do they have to be told that you have to be accepting of LGBTQ students?
To my knowledge, CMS says parents can opt out of some of these things, and if they have any concerns, CMS said that they should go to the principals and teachers first.
So in what way does that violate parental rights?
Well, I know one parent who was there that day did say that her student was given an assignment where they were reading material about a gay student who was murdered in college, and she didn't feel comfortable with the assignment. The student didn't, but then the student was removed from class. So the parent said, well, that was inappropriate because her daughter just wanted a different assignment. Now, this is someone's, you know, anecdotal perspective, but that is one parent who said she wasn't happy because her daughter was then taken out of class because of an assignment she didn't feel comfortable with.
Okay. Banks met this week. Both the big banks met this week, had their shareholders meeting, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. Bank of America, I believe, had their meeting here, right?
They do it every year here. Yeah.
And Wells Fargo held their meeting in Des Moines, Iowa. Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan took the opportunity to stand firm on his company's decision to stop serving some gun makers in the aftermath of the Parkland, Florida school shooting. What does that mean, Dion Roberts?
Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, a top executive for Bank of America went on television and said, basically, we're ending all funding for our clients who make these assault-style weapons that are used for non-military use. And Moynihan sort of doubled down on that at the shareholder meeting on Wednesday and said, look, here's the reality. We've got about 150 of our own employees who have come to us and said that we've been directly affected by these recent shootings, you know, the Orlando shooting, the Parkland shooting.
Las Vegas.
Right. Mm-hmm. And said, you know, we're responding to what our customers tell us. We're responding to what our own employees tell us.
And he doubled down on that despite, I think, or after, a shareholder stood up and said the bank was following the whim of the moment and not looking out for the long-term interests of shareholders by willfully giving up money.
Right. And that shareholder said, you know, basically, look, Warren Buffett, you know, one of the most famous investors around, has said that he's not going to take similar action, you know, at his company. But another person stood up right after that guy and said, you know, and this person was really kind of getting emotional and said, you know, I'm so proud of this company for taking this stand and saying that we're not going to fund these companies.
Yeah, but they're a business, and the shareholders bought stock because they want to make money. So how do you balance money and the need to make money with whatever moral obligations you view to society? It's admirable that they have these moral obligations or they feel these moral obligations, but how do you balance that?
Well, we are in an era right now where you have a lot of shareholders who are not just looking at, and this isn't all shareholders, but a lot of shareholders are looking not just at the profitability of a company, but what is your social agenda?
Mm-hmm.
And they are investing in companies that are aligned with their social beliefs. And so I think Bank of America is just saying, look, we're going to listen to this group of people.
Well, at that same meeting, protesters interrupted the proceedings to take issue with the bank providing funding for the Atlantic Coast pipelines. Aside from momentary drama, did it have any effect?
I don't think so. I mean,
why one issue and not the other?
Well, I think that there's probably a lot more political pressure right now on the guns issue. I don't think that the Atlantic Coast pipeline is a household name in America, but certainly the gun issue is.
Okay. There were calls at Wells Fargo and their shareholder meeting in Des Moines for that bank to cut ties with the National Rifle Association, something the company says, quote, it's discussing. I don't know what that means. But I suppose the bigger news out of that meeting was the California State Treasurer, John Chang, who called for the ouster of Wells CEO, saying, time has proven Tim Sloan cannot drain the swamp. He has become it. It is time for him to go. Now, the California State Treasurer probably wields a lot of power at that shareholder. I mean, they must have a lot of stock in Wells Fargo. What was Sloan's response?
Well, John Chang stood up multiple times to address Sloan, and he's been critical of Sloan for, you know, really since the sales scandal in September 2016 erupted. You know, they're a big customer, California is, but Tim Sloan said, look, we are making all these changes at the bank. We are trying to turn this thing around. We've fired executives. We've got new board members, and we're cleaning things up. But what's interesting is every time they say that they are moving ahead, a new issue pops up. Just yesterday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Department of Labor is investigating Wells Fargo for the way it handles 401ks for companies that it manages the 401k plans for, and that it's steering people as they roll over those 401ks into IRAs. It's putting them into these really high-cost IRAs and different investments, and that's not good for the customer. It's good for Wells Fargo. And so who knows where that's going to go, but it's this drip of scandals and issues that continue to plague the bank.
And is that a new move? Did that happen, this allegation? If they're alleging that the bank is putting people into investments that churn profit for the bank but hurt the investor, is that something that has happened under Tim Sloan, or did it start prior to his coming into the position of CEO?
So because this issue sounds like it's in the early stages of being investigated, I don't think we have a timeline yet.
Okay.
But I know the board is also investigating the wealth and investment management operation, and federal authorities are investigating that as well. So I think, you know, you're going to hear about more findings potentially this year at Wells Fargo.
There are so many choices in the banking world. How have they maintained a customer base after all this?
Have you ever tried to change banks?
It's hard.
It is hard. I mean, once you've got direct deposit, once you've got all these different things with these banks, it's just really not easy to do. And unless you're really upset, it's a drag to try to move everything over.
So this meeting followed these huge fines that may, I think, be levied against Wells Fargo by the Consumer Protection Bureau and the Comptroller of the Currency,
yes.
Mick Mulvaney's organization up in Washington. Mm-hmm. These are $1 billion fines, which sound enormous, but in reality are not, because they won't even impact a quarter's worth of profit. But how did shareholders react to it at this meeting?
You know, the fine didn't really come up a whole lot during the meeting, but you did hear people, again, just complaining about the scandals and the bad headlines that continue to come out against Wells Fargo. I think some shareholders are just sick of hearing about it.
Okay. Whoa. All right. Well, lots of things will continue into the future on this roundup discussion today. CMPD officers were back this week at City Council to repeat their request for a pay raise. Some officers are saying they can't afford to live here. Why two pitches and I think 3 or 4 months, Glenn, for the same, or Kirsten, in the same 3 or 4 months? Why two pitches for a raise?
I think to show that they're really serious, that they need this raise, and that they believe they deserve this raise. And I know they haven't had a raise in a while. And the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 9, is asking for a 15% raise. And if the city could grant that, it would cost taxpayers nearly $22 million just to grant that. So it is a hefty lift for city council. But this is a new city council. So, you know, we'll see if maybe that sways things. But we did see more than 200 officers make this last pitch.
And the city council also is concerned about affordable housing. We'll talk about that when we come back, because there was a little rift that developed as they discussed affordable housing this week, and the Atrium saga continues. Those and other stories when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our Charlotte Talks roundtable of reporters includes Glenn Birkins, the editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, our own Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News Charlotte, and Dion Roberts, business reporter for the Charlotte Observer. The city council also met this week and talked about affordable housing. They, I think, voted to finance 11, is that correct, proposed affordable apartment projects around the city. Last winter, council had asked developers to propose affordable projects that would be eligible for subsidies, where monthly rents would start at just under $400. Do the 11 projects that the council decided to fund represent all the developments offered by the builders, or are there more to come?
So yes and no. All 11 got City Council's blessings, but all 11 won't be built this year, likely, because 9 of them are trying to get a 9% state tax credit. I can't talk today. I combined the two words. And so 9 of those projects are in the running for really only 3 grants from the state. So those will likely get funded. And then also two of them are in the running for 4% state tax credits. And those will also get some help from city council. So at least it's safe to say maybe five of those will probably be built this year because they'll get money later this year.
So this is very complex. If I understand this correctly, this approval of 11 proposed projects represents, what, $16 million in expenditures by the city on affordable housing?
Yes, right? From mayor, different places.
Okay, and the mayor wants, there's going to be a bond. There's a bond every 2 years to fund the affordable housing.
Yeah, the Housing Trust Fund. Yes,
trust
exactly.
Fund. Yeah. So the mayor, and it's usually about what?
$15 million.
The mayor wants $50 million in the bond proposal. She also has asked the faith community and the, don't just ignore that, the faith community and the business community to kick in additional $50 million each, because $150 million is what she says we need. The Observer reported that this vote illustrated a split on affordable housing this week on philosophy, and that the mayor chided the council for this mixed stance. I really didn't understand that. Do you understand what that's all about?
I think the thing is, what stuff is with these 11 projects, it will help people across the board. So those who are making the less than 30% average median income, as well as up to more of the 80%. But past studies have shown city council has plenty of affordable housing for those who are in the upper part of that spectrum. So those who can afford 80% AMI. It's the super low income households that really need help. So some of the newer council members are saying, well, are we doing enough to help these low income families? Can't we be doing more? And Mayor Lyle said, well, this is a very complex issue with a very complex answer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the thing. And she said this whole discussion, their whole debate, I mean, that vote was followed by an hour discussion about how to solve affordable housing. And it's one of those things. There is no one clear answer. And I think that's what the mayor was trying to allude to, is that this is a very complicated issue that will take multiple strategies. And this is a start with trying to subsidize projects that will get some funding from the state.
Okay. Well done, because that's really complex.
It takes a long time to figure it out. I got a whole week to prepare for that, so thank you.
Last week, we talked about City Council Member LaWanna Mayfield's Facebook post, which suggested that 9/11 was a conspiracy and that the felling of the Twin Towers in New York and the crash of the airplane into the Pentagon wasn't real, and that the Twin Towers were felled because it was a controlled demolition. She says she's yet to be presented with evidence that airplanes caused the collapse. Well, that comment, of course, caused a flurry of consternation, which we talked about last week. And some said they were hurt by that. This week, she appeared on WCNC-TV's Flashpoint and apologized for the pain and hurt she caused with those comments.
I should not have shared the post. But I did not share a post with the idea or the expectation to cause hurt, harm, or damage. It was me sharing a partial thought.
I suppose that's one way of putting it. But in that same interview, when asked if she thought planes brought down the World Trade Center, Mayfield said,
"What I believe is that we lost Americans during this event. What I believe is that after this event, our nation then identified a segment of the community and said, this community is now terrorist. And from that moment, we have been saying terrorists, 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 but we have not said for, honestly, those who are white Americans that have committed mass killings since that time will not get that title.
So is that really what this is about, Glenn? Is this simply what she perceives to be a double standard?
I'm not sure what this is about, actually. we've got video footage of the planes flying into the tower.
I think we all saw it.
Yeah, we all saw it. And that second plane, we watched it live. It was a horrible day for our nation. It was a horrible day for the people and the families affected. I'm not sure why she decided to go there. I was hoping when she issued her apology that she would state definitively that planes did cause that. There is absolutely no evidence to the contrary. We saw it. 9/11 continues to be a very sensitive spot for our country.
Am I the only one in the room who hadn't heard about the demolition theory until Luana brought this up?
You had not heard
No, I had not.
No, it's been there on a number of different theories, and these theories come from different places, and according to the conspiracy theorist, different actors were at play to bring down the towers, including the American government. They're conspiracy theories. Right. I don't know what to even say about that.
Okay, let's move on then, because I think we've picked that apart as much as we can without being psychologists. The Atrium saga continues. They have now decided, the hospital has now decided to release some doctors from their non-compete restrictions. Mecklenburg Medical Group had announced their intention to leave. They asked to be released. Atrium said yes. Why, Dion?
Well, I think one reason is the system is saying, Atrium is saying that they want the, and this is a different deal, but they want the anesthesiologists who work for a vendor that they've cut ties with.
Mednax,
yeah, Southeast Anesthesiology Consultants. They want those people to be released from their non-compete agreements so they can come to work for Atrium. So, I know this is a little complicated, but
yes, it is.
It would be hypocritical, I think, for Atrium to say, hey, we want you, Mednax, to let these doctors go from their non-competes so they can still work at our hospitals, but we're not going to release Mecklenburg Medical Group from their non-competes. So I think it's a little bit of that.
There was another ad in the paper where the hospital is refuting claims made by Southeast Anesthesiology Group about the safety of patients and how the hospital operates. And this is an ongoing battle, a very public battle. This has got to be a PR person's nightmare. But the hospital CEO, Gene Woods, told our Alex Olgan that he's not worried that this is that what's going on here with these ads and people being released from their non-competes and leaving, that he doesn't think this is going to be the start of a mass exodus of doctors.
The answer is unequivocally no. But people change in terms of what they want. And we can't force people to want the same things that we want.
So 92 doctors, I believe it's 92, are exiting with Mecklenburg Medical, and the hospital says they've already recruited 21 doctors to fill the slots. This all ends, this contract ends September the 1st. Will they have enough doctors by then?
Well, right now, with the 20-some-odd that they've recruited, and then there are about 14 who are not leaving, they have about 30 doctors at this point. Now, keep in mind, the practice has 104 currently, mm-hmm. So they've got to do some more recruiting. But, you know, Gene Woods was very confident that, you know, we're going to be able to bring talented people in. We're an attractive organization to work for. So we'll see what happens by September 1st.
And are they offering bonuses as well?
That's a good point. Yeah, and so Atrium is worried, honestly, that they're going to lose the support staff. So like the nurses and the lab technicians, that those people are going to go with these physicians. And so they offered retention bonuses of up to 10% of their salary if they stay through the end of this year. And I asked Gene Woods this week about that, and you know, he said we were hearing from our employees. They were worried about the future of their group, and we did this so that we could, you know, alleviate some fears. And honestly, they don't want to see these people go. Mm.
He's also told WFAE's Alex Olgan that the media needs to understand the hospital a little better, and he made a case with her about spreading what he sees as good news.
We are a treasured asset in this community that any community in this country would be blessed to have. I say that from with knowledge from the American Hospital Association chairmanship that I had last year, and I've seen hospitals and systems from coast to coast. So as you are holding us accountable for the things that you need to do because it's your job and you need to share with the community, I would invite you also to spend as much time telling the stories about what a community asset this is.
Okay, so media folks, is that our job?
Our job is to tell the truth and, you know, seek all the facts. I'll just say that.
I mean, we're not the PR machine for the hospital.
Correct. And I have not covered the Atrium situation as much, but I will say I think our job is to, again, look for the facts and see where they lead us.
I mean, that sounds like somebody complaining that very nicely complaining that they have been unfairly treated or misunderstood. Is that the case, do you think?
I think that if you polled any CEO in America, they would want to see more positive coverage of their companies than what the media give them. I will say that we at The Observer, I'm sure, everyone in this room who does their jobs, we try to put balance in our stories. And when we do negative stories, we there's an opportunity there for the other side to say, well, hey, but we're doing all this other great stuff as well. And we do put that in our coverage. So I'm not quite sure exactly what he wants to see us report on, but that's his opinion.
Well, bad news sells newspapers. It causes clicks on websites. It causes people to tune into television and radio program. Good news is kind of boring.
Well, I think more than that. I think just the nature of news is the anomaly. And this isn't my analogy, but every day thousands of planes take off from Charlotte Douglas Airport. That's not news. If one of those planes goes down, that's news.
That's news, yeah. Okay, early voting is underway for the May primary. Do we know what turnout has looked like so far?
Yes. Okay. So for in-person, we have had 948 people vote, and then with absentee, it is up to 1,180. So
is that good?
That was only one location, the Hal Marshall Center, so that's pretty good for one location. But today, the Board of Elections is opening 15 early voting sites, and that's the first time they've done that during a primary.
There are two key races in Mecklenburg County, the race for district attorney. We had both candidates on this program on Tuesday, I believe. And then on Wednesday, we had the three candidates for sheriff on this program, in a program that David Borax hosted. Are voters paying attention to these two races? And they seem to be semi-connected.
We will see. I mean, I hope voters are paying attention because both of those races will be decided May 8th. They do not have any Republican challengers in either one of these races, so there is only a Democratic primary.
Whoever wins the primary will be the next district attorney and the next sheriff.
Right. So literally.
And I think part of what makes those races interesting is that they're probably the most competitive, or they may prove to be the most competitive races in the primary. I've said before, Charlotte's demographics have changed, and currently African American voters hold the balance of power when we talk about countywide races. And in both of those races, the African American vote or what happens too with the African American vote will be crucial.
Well, both candidates in the DA's race are African American. The incumbent Democrat Irwin Carmichael in the sheriff's race is white, but is Antoine Ensley African American? He is.
Yes.
So the other two challengers, Antoine and Gary McFadden, are both African American.
And so people are watching or will be watching to see how that's going to play out. Will they split the African American vote, thereby handing the current sheriff a win, or will they tend to go with one candidate or the other? I think that's what's really driving the interest in that race in particular.
And I think, too, it's the issues that involve that a lot of people really care about. Say, for instance, in the sheriff's race, you have people who are really concerned about the in-person visits going to video now. You have a lot of people who are upset over that they cannot have that in-person contact with the district attorney's office. You have a lot of people who are upset in terms of how African Americans and people of color, period, are treated by the system and the high numbers of people of color who end up in that judicial process. So I think a lot of people really care about these issues, and that's why I think they're paying a lot of attention and going back even to the protest and especially with the district attorney's office and some of the things that they both are saying they're going to try to do to bring the public more in and more involved in the office.
You didn't mention 287G with regard to the sheriff's race.
Yes.
Is that playing a role outside of the immigrant community?
I don't know how much of a role that's playing. What I'm surprised has not gotten traction was Sheriff Carmichael's canceled gun auction. I just knew when that happened that would be the political albatross around his neck during the primaries. But so far, neither candidate has appeared to make much hay of it.
And before we leave today, we have to send out some congratulations to two WFAE News people who won the Edward R. Murrow Award this week. Sarah D'Elia won the hard news category for her story on how the shooting by police of Ruben Galindo has impacted his family. And Lisa Wharf won the investigative reporting category for her story on the Charlotte School of Law student paying students not to take the bar. So congratulations to them. And thanks to Gwendolyn Glenn from WFAE News, Kirsten Garrett from Spectrum News Charlotte, Dion Roberts from the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com for the hour.